This show is pre-recorded and furnished by Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn.
It's time for Gervy's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervy. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. And now, here's your host, Alan Gervy.
Good evening, Los Angeles, and everyone listening all around the world on KABC.com. I am Alan Gervy, the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn. And today, on this lovely day, I am here to be the managing partner of your life. And I've got two incredible guests who will help manage your life. You need to listen to what they have to say because it's going to be helpful as we move forward in 2021. I first want to start off, though, just on a thought on Valentine's Day. Valentine's Day gives us the freedom to love, and I'm just not sure why in our society today there aren't more people that are taking advantage of this basic freedom, a freedom to love. I love having the two guests that I want to introduce to you now on with me. They are experts in constitutional law and other areas of law, as well as probably life, but we're not going to get into the life lessons right now, but we're going to talk a lot about the Supreme Court and constitutional law. First, I want to introduce to everyone Erwin Shemerinsky, who is the Dean of Berkeley Law, and he's been the Dean of Berkeley Law since July 1st, 2017. Before that, he was the founding dean in the University of California Irvine School of Law and the Raymond Pike Professor of First Amendment Law. Erwin is the Jesse H. Choper Distinguished Professor of Law at Berkeley Law. He is the author of many books. His recent books include We the People, A Progressive Reading of the Constitution for the 21st Century, and Closing the Courthouse Doors, How Your Constitutional Rights Became Unenforceable. He's written many law review articles. He writes for the Sacramento Bee, frequently argues appellate cases, including in the Supreme Court. And in 2017, he was named the National Jurist Magazine's Dean Shemerinsky as the most influential person in legal education in the United States. Some high praise. Also joining us for a little bit of a fun debate. Are debates ever fun? I don't know. I thought so back in school. I was a debater, and they were a lot of fun. So hopefully people look at things in a lighter way instead of the ad hominems and the criticisms and everything that we see in today's world. Ilya Soman is the law professor at George Mason University. When I say the law professor, I mean he is the law professor at George Mason University. He's a scholar at the Cato Institute. He blogs for the Volokh Conspiracy. Eugene Volokh, been on the show many times. He's a former co-editor of the Supreme Court Economic Review. He's the author of Free to Move, Foot Voting, Migration, and Political Freedom. He's also authored Democracy and Political Ignorance, Why Smaller Government is Smarter. He often participates in the New York Times Room for Debate forum. He's a prolific writer as well in all media. Both Erwin and Ilya can be found anywhere if you Google them, so take a look at that. Gentlemen, welcome back to Gervy's Law.
Great to be with you.
See, we're pretending like we actually have a studio audience. But of course, we can't have gatherings, except maybe if we call it a religious event, and we're going to get into that case shortly. But I'm really happy to have you both on. I haven't spoken to both of you for a long time. First, I want to start with you, Erwin. Before we get into the nitty-gritty here, tell us a little bit about how things have been going at Berkeley Law and how you've been doing as the dean and what's happening in the pandemic and how are your students doing?
We've been entirely online since March 16th. All classes at the end of last spring, all classes last fall, and all classes this semester are done remotely. Our faculty and students have done a remarkable job of adapting to it. Undoubtedly, for some students, there's real hardship. Many of our students have struggled with illness, or family members have struggled with illness. Some students struggle more for learning online. But overall, I think everyone's doing well and just looking forward to hopefully being back in person and some semblance of normalcy in August.
I think everyone is looking forward to that. And, you know, I really appreciate what you just said. And you don't realize how honest you are when you talk about some of the problems that have existed. My kids go to a private school here in L.A. They're 7 and 8 years old. And we are getting emails from the administration saying every kid is where they should be. Everything is wonderful. And they've been, of course, remote learning. And I can tell you for a fact, watching the Zoom calls, that everything isn't wonderful and every kid isn't where they should be. Just this week I was watching a Zoom call. There's kids eating, there are kids playing with pets, there are kids playing with their siblings, there's kids who just disappear, you don't know where they are, there's kids who are talking to other people. So Professor Chemerinsky, Dean Chemerinsky, when you talk about this, everyone really has to be a little bit sympathetic for some of the kids who may not be doing as well in law school or any other school. How do we get back to normal when we can get things back in school?
There's so many levels of complexity in answering that question. You know, when you talk about elementary school or high school, you're talking about some students who have not been able to advance as they should. I worry, because I focus on the law school level, what's that going to mean for us, you know, 5, 6, 7 years down the road in terms of the students who were disadvantaged? Let's also be honest. There is a class dimension to this. Students from disadvantaged backgrounds are going to suffer more. Race and class correlate in our society. I worry about Black and Latinx students struggling more. So it's enormously difficult. In law school right now, we're less going to face that problem. I think the immediate question is going to be for the fall semester, is it realistic to expect that everyone is going to be able to be in person and back to normal? Will we need to have some form of blended classes where some are in the room and some are online? And how do we go about doing that in a way that's effective education for everyone? At this stage, it's just too soon to make plans for the fall 2021 semester. I think we've got to see how vaccinations go in the public health situation and wait really for a few months before we make any choices for the fall.
I hope that people, especially in the administration, will be somewhat creative and be able to change programs if necessary, because I think if you take the perspective that you're just going to get back to where you were, whenever that will be, that may be a little too optimistic. Turning to you, Ilya, tell us your experience as a law professor at George Mason University. Tell us how that has been, how teaching has been remotely, and how you see the future of trying to get the law students back to where they need to be so that they can join society eventually as law school graduates.
So I'm obviously not a dean like Dean Chemerinsky, so I don't have the same administrative responsibilities. But here at George Mason, we have in fact been teaching in-person classes in the fall semester and again in this semester. We also have some hybrid classes and some fully remote ones, but particularly for first-year students and for many students in required courses beyond the first year, if they want to be in person, we ensure that they get that opportunity. We also have other students who, for a variety of reasons, many of them entirely understandable, do not want to be in person at this time, and we work with them as well. In the fall, I taught a purely in-person class. Right now, I'm teaching two hybrid classes where I and some students are in person, there are other students who are remote. There are some technical difficulties there. I won't say that it's ideal, but I think it's far superior for many students, at least, to pure remote education. And I think our university and others have shown that this can be done at relatively minimal risk. During the entire fall semester and this semester, we've had only a few COVID cases out of many thousands of students at George Mason, not just law students, but also undergraduate students. And by the way, I think there's a similar experience with private schools that have been open throughout this area and also with those public schools that have been willing to break down the political resistance of interest groups and remain open. Obviously, there are precautions. We're at a greater distance from each other than we normally would be with fewer people in a given room. We're required to wear masks, which is annoying and unpleasant, but a reasonable price to pay given the situation. And I do look forward to when vaccination spreads more widely and we can dispense with all or most of those precautions. But I think, at least for a lot of institutions, the time to do in-person education and not be satisfied with pure remote education is right now. I think our university and others have shown that it can be done. It's also in line with the views of the head of the CDC that the that President Biden recently appointed as well.
So I have a tough...
I want to really strongly disagree with something you said. You certainly can make judgments for what's best for your institution, but it sounded like to me like you were making a pronouncement for other institutions. You know nothing about the public health situation here in the Bay Area. You know nothing about the Alameda County or Berkeley City orders. So to the extent it sounded like you were making a judgment for my school, I deeply resent that.
And that's a good point.
I can't make a definitive judgment for every school. You're certainly right about that. That said, I think schools in a variety of parts of the country with a variety of different public health situations have shown that it is, in fact, feasible to do the sort of arrangement that we've been doing here.
It's so interesting because both of you, you know, you're talking from the heart. They're words, but it's coming from the heart because I know you both have perspectives. Is this a political a science question, a political question, or is it the teachers' union? You know, we have an administrator, when we're talking about Dean Chemerinsky, a teacher, so to speak, and I don't mean to, you know, belittle either of you in one regard or another, but a professor. Why is it, and Dean Chemerinsky makes a great point, you know, you can't pass judgment on other areas, but I'm in an area, and I'll tell you, it's in Calabasas, California, and there's a private school 3 miles away from the school my kids go to. One is back in school, and ours is, and ours is on a 2.5 hour. They go in 2.5 hours, and then the parents have to take a break from their day, or whoever helps them take them back home so that they start remote learning. And it's really a mess. But to Dean Chemerinsky's point, this is in the same area. Can you reconcile, either of you, what's going on, whether it is, you know, what the CDC chairperson says, or whether it's a political thing, Governor Newsom, or maybe it's just, I don't know, just someone interpreting science differently?
I hope it's about science and public health. One of my greatest criticisms of Donald Trump is the way he politicized the pandemic and divided us politically over what should be a question of science and public health. And different areas of the country are in different places with regard to this. We happen, for example, to be in an area where the county and the city have closure orders. So our campus is closed by county and city orders, where I couldn't open my law school in the way that Ilya suggests if I wanted to tomorrow. I also think we have to look at the science information in terms of transmission, which may be very different at the college level than at the elementary school level. I think it's enormously difficult questions, and I really don't think anybody should be making judgments about what other schools should be doing.
Ilya?
So I agree certainly that science has to play an important role, but I don't think that public health questions or any public policy questions can just purely be questions of science. They're also questions of values and questions of utility and practicality. And I think when you look at what the CDC has been saying, when you look at the experience around the country and in Europe and elsewhere as well, there is a very strong case for reopening schools and also universities in the vast majority of places. I fully realize that I can't pass judgment every single school in every single location, and I certainly don't have the kind of responsibilities that Dean Chemerinsky had, so I have to be diffident about saying, well, if I were in his place, I would definitely do something differently, because I can't know that with any certainty. That said, I think the evidence is pretty strong that at least in most places we should have open schools. And where we have had it, including in this area with private schools, even though the public schools have been largely shut down, I think it's been shown that the benefit is well worth the risk. I grant that's not a purely scientific judgment. It's also a question of values, morality, and justice, including some of the points that Dean Chemerinsky adverted to earlier, which is that the most disadvantaged students often are the ones who suffer the most when we don't have in-person learning. So people in my economic class or Dean Chemerinsky's class, remote education is a difficulty for our kids. If we have them, it is probably not as much so as it is for, people who are in a different place on the economic ladder. So I think it's a mistake to ignore science, but I also think it's a mistake to have the mantra of saying, well, this is just a purely technical scientific question, because I don't think that can be the case.
Well, I know that it's a difficult question with even more difficult answers. We're going to move on after the break. I don't think the two of us, or the three of us rather, are going to resolve this. But hopefully with vaccinations and distancing, things can get closer to normal in the next several months. We're going to be back with Ilya Soman and Erwin Chemerinsky after this break. You're listening to Gervais Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
The glass is always half full when you're listening to Gervais Law on Talk Radio 790 KABC. Welcome back to Gervais Law, turning Murphy's Law upside down on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
And we are back. I really wish we didn't have to spend so much time talking about the different issues during the pandemic, but that's the reality of the world we are living in. There's so many other issues that are so important to our society and to our own country. But of course, I think, and I'm sure Ilya Soman and Erwin Chemerinsky will agree with me, you can't really get to a lot of them until we take care of the situation having to deal with the pandemic and getting everyone back to at least a place where they can make a living, they can send their kids to school, we can develop brilliant lawyers through the law schools, and everything else that our society needs moving forward. We are going to move on to some other, I would say, disputatious issues. And before we get to Supreme Court cases, I do want to talk about the elephant in the room, so to speak. And by the way, the room consists right now of law professor at George Mason University, Ilya Soman, and the dean of Berkeley Law, Erwin Chemerinsky. That's our room. I'm Alan Gervais, and you're listening to Gervais Law. Elephant in the room, and I hate to say this, guys, because I know it's just been asked so many times. Just want to get your perspective, maybe a little bit of conflict here. Impeachment. Horrible word to start with, but I guess I can't avoid it. I'm going to start with Dean Chemerinsky. Constitutional or not, when a president is no longer in office?
We have to recognize the Constitution just doesn't say. The Constitution says that the president can be impeached and removed for treason, bribery, and high crimes and misdemeanors. It says if the president isn't impeached by the House, there's a trial in the Senate, and the Chief Justice presides. People I respect say that implies that it's something that's done just to a sitting president. But I also think, and I'm persuaded by strong arguments, that it is permissible after somebody's left office to have the trial. In part, history supports that. During the Ulysses Grant presidency, William Belknap, the Secretary of War, resigned. After his resignation, he was impeached by the House, and he was tried in the Senate. In fact, if you go back to English precedent, and impeachment is based on English law, there were instances of people being impeached and tried after they left office. John Adams in 1800 said it was permissible. And I think that there's an important policy reason for this. If the president does something outrageous, and I think Donald Trump did, near the end of the presidency, there needs to be the remedy of the condemnation that comes from impeachment and trial. So I think this is permissible what the Senate's about to embark on tomorrow.
Real quickly, just a quick follow-up. If it is permissible, is it really worth the time now, especially given the fact that it looks like the Senate will never convict?
I would say yes, because I think it's important to send a message now and for the future that what President Trump did was beyond the pale. It was a tremendous abuse of office. I believe it meets the legal test under the First Amendment for incitement. And the alternative is to do nothing. And that seems to me worse than going forward with this trial, even if it splits along partisan votes, to have a majority of the Senate say, or 50 senators say, that what was done justified conviction. I think that's an important message for the future.
Unless, of course, that can be accomplished through the private arena outside of the presidency, which is another question, whether our legal system can address issues that come up during the presidency or with this past president, maybe things that can be pinned on him after he leaves. Any thoughts on that?
Are you asking me?
No, I haven't got to you. Ilya, I haven't got to you yet. We got a whole different topic.
I apologize. Sorry.
No, don't apologize.
Sorry, that's my fault because I didn't realize this directed towards me.
Yeah, no, I'm just, it's your second follow-up, and then I'm going to I'm gonna rest and go to Ilya.
Sure. I think there is an importance to formal proceedings as a way of expressing condemnation. I think part of what we want the criminal justice system to do is to express for the community condemnation for certain behavior. I think it's important that there be condemnation from the House and the Senate for what Donald Trump did on January 6th, and for that matter, the weeks leading up to January 6th. I've read very closely the speech that Donald Trump gave, where he used the word fight 20 times, where Rudy Giuliani on the same platform said, we need trial by combat. When you look at all of the context, that was incitement in a way that we've never seen a president of the United States engage in before. And I think that needs to be condemned. And that's why I think the House needs to vote the article of impeachment and why the Senate needs to do this, even if the Republicans won't vote to convict.
Okay. Now, I'm going to turn it over now to Professor Soman. Now, you talk a lot about originalism, and Dean Chemerinsky mentioned that it's not clear whether it's in the Constitution or not. He gave examples of why he believes that the impeachment, the conviction, is proper. Is there a way, appealing to originalism, is there a way to know what the Constitution said and meant with respect to impeachment on this issue?
Yeah, I actually agree with virtually everything Irwin has just said on this issue, that while the words in and of themselves don't specifically address this question, if you look at the context in which they were written, which as originalists, if you are an originalist, you would do, I think it's pretty clear that it covers former officials as well as current ones. The wording of the impeachment clause and the whole institution of impeachment was borrowed by the framers from British precedent, and they well knew that the British had done impeachments of former officials, including indeed the most famous British impeachment of the 18th century, which was quite familiar to the founders, was that of Warren Hastings, the former British governor of India, who was impeached by the British Parliament. And in addition, there is this other textual point that I would add to the ones that were made by Irwin, which is that removal from office isn't the only penalty that can be imposed if a person who is impeached is convicted. If the Senate wants to, they can also bar that person from holding federal public office in the future. And it just doesn't make sense if the person who's impeached can avoid that penalty simply by resigning their office and therefore preventing the Senate from even considering whether they should be barred from holding office in the future. That seems to be a kind of an absurd consequence of that interpretation, and is that there's a general legal principle that where, if at all possible, we try to avoid absurd interpretations of the law. So while it's true the text doesn't directly speak to this question when read in context, and when read as a whole, I think the impeachment provisions of the Constitution do cover former officials, and I think particularly in a case where the actual impeachment happened, the impeachment by the House happened while Trump was still in office. It's only the trial that will happen afterwards. I think that further strengthens the case.
Okay, follow-up question, similar to the one that I asked Dean Chemerinsky, and that is, if that's the case, and if there is enough precedence and interpretation to follow through with the impeachment, is it worth the distraction, if it is a distraction, and I know people argue, of course, it isn't, to go ahead and proceed, especially given the fact where it looks like the Senate will not convict, given the makeup of the Senate, not because there shouldn't be a conviction, just because of the makeup of the Senate. Is this worth it?
On balance, yes, I think for all the reasons that Irwin mentioned. In addition, I don't think it's 100% certain that he will be acquitted. It's likely, but not certain. But depending on how the trial goes and how public opinion goes, there's a chance that, even if only a small chance, that will go the other way. But even if you get not a conviction, but just a substantial majority of senators saying he should be convicted for the first time in all of American history, having more than one senator of being willing to convict the president of their own party, which is likely to happen here, I think that would be a worthwhile statement. I would add also, realistically, it is only going to take maybe a week or so, so I don't think it's that much of a distraction from other business. And frankly, some of the other business the Senate is likely to do may be passing legislation that I'm not sure it's a great idea to pass anyway. So if it is a distraction, it's as likely to be a distraction from Congress doing problematic things as from Congress doing good things.
All right, we only have a minute before the break, and I want to just introduce this case. We'll continue talking about it after the break. We'll just get a little brief discussion before we have to break, and that is the South Bay United Pentecostal Church versus Newsom decision that just came out last week from the Supreme Court. And it's interesting on a number of different levels, including, of course, that it was Amy Coney Barrett's first signed decision, opinion. And a lot of people say that this case is a little bit of a mess because there's so many different areas and angles to it, essentially saying that the church can avoid rules on COVID-19 prevention as prescribed by the California government. When we come back, we're going to talk to Dean Chemerinsky, Professor Soman, about that case and others. You're listening to Gervais Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Law, the intersection of law and life on Talk Radio 790 KABC. Welcome back to Gervais Law, turning Murphy's Law upside down on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
You know, we never have enough time to talk to our guests on this show, but we still have two more segments, and I want to get right to it. We're talking to professor at George Mason University, Ilya Soman, and the dean of Berkeley Law, Irwin Chemerinsky. And fellas, here we're going to talk a little bit of the South Bay United Pentecostal Church versus Newsom. We talked earlier in this program about whether closure of schools or remote learning was a health issue, a political issue. Now we're going to talk about whether it can be a religious issue as well. First, we'll start with Dean Chemerinsky. Tell us about this case and why the religious issue apparently trumps the public health issue and maybe political one as well, given the decision of the Supreme Court.
This is the second time this has been before the Supreme Court. And I think it's important to note that what the Supreme Court did on February 5th was in part ruling in favor of the religious institution, but in part upholding the governor's order. There were three things that were before the court. One was a restriction in the areas where COVID is most prevalent on indoor worship services. And the Supreme Court, and it was 6-3, enjoined that from being in effect. The second thing was a prohibition on chanting and singing in these services, and the Supreme Court allowed that to remain in effect. And the third was saying when there's religious services, it can't be more than 25% of the usual capacity, and the Supreme Court allowed that to remain in effect. So the religious institution won on one of three issues and lost on two of the three issues. The last time they were before the court, they lost on all of the issues. But like so much with regard to COVID, there is an ideological split. Like so much with regard to religion, there's an ideological split. The six in the majority were the six conservative justices, Roberts, Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett. And Thomas and Gorsuch would have struck down all three of these requirements. And the three in dissent were Kagan writing, joined by Breyer and Sotomayor. And I think that reflects a different way in which conservatives and liberals are looking at the issue. Justice Kagan talked about the need for deference to the government and making choices to stop the spread of COVID. But I also think it reflects a difference in attitudes with regard to free exercise of religion.
You know, when we talk about the breakdown that you just provided, and thank you for that, Professor Soman, is there hypocrisy here when you look at some of the other activities? And I know this comes up all along with these issues, the COVID issues, when they talk about, for instance, Hollywood film sets and talking about different types of situations where people can sing or can use their voices. You know, the Super Bowl last Sunday. There were a lot of people in that stadium afterwards. A lot of people celebrated in Tampa. How do we reconcile the hypocrisy of what can be done and what can't? And why is the Supreme Court so instrumental in giving opinions in that regard?
So I think there's a couple of different questions there. I don't know if I can even begin to fully do justice to them in the time that we have, but I would say a couple of things. One is that, yes, there's a lot of hypocrisy here, I think, on the part of both blue and red state governments in various ways that often, while I think science plays a role in these decisions, also various kinds of political judgment and the powers of various interest groups also play a role. So I think there's a good chance that the power of Hollywood and other similar interest groups in California played a role in the decision there. Obviously, the fact that people were allowed to attend the Super Bowl and other such events, that reflects the popularity of those events and various political factors. And that, by the way, I think is also a reason why it's a mistake to say, well, these are just expert technical public health decisions, therefore the court should just defer to them. Because if you do that, that misses an important dimension of them, which is that often technical scientific aspects are only one part of these decisions. There's also a wide range of political factors, moral factors, and so on. There is also, unfortunately, I think, a degree of hypocrisy on the part of various Supreme Court justices, both left and right, in that you see a case here where the liberal justices say, well, this is a matter of technical public health. We have to defer to the scientists and the experts. But just a couple years ago, when we had the travel ban case, it was the conservative justices saying, we get to defer to the government special expertise on national security and immigration, whereas the liberal justices were saying, no, we have to look at the fact that, and I think correctly look at the fact that the real motive for this was discriminatory and strike it down. You can say similar things about the war on terror, where also in many of those cases, the conservative justices said, we have to defer to government's expertise. Liberal justices said otherwise. And here you almost see a flip compared to those cases. So to my mind, whenever an important constitutional right is at stake, the government or the courts should not simply defer to the experts. It should look closely to see whether scientific expertise really is the motive behind the decision or not, which sometimes it isn't. And B, even if it is, it's still important to ask, is the expertise being used within constitutional constraints? And I don't think that the public health field has some kind of immunity either to the tendency to use science as part of a political agenda or to the tendency to override important constitutional rights in a crisis. Indeed, some of the most harmful and dangerous unconstitutional practices in American history were in fact taken in the name of public health. There is the famous case of Buck versus Bell, mandatory sterilization of the mentally ill, which was upheld on the basis that public health experts of that era wanted to do it. Segregation was defended by some on a public health basis, and there are other notorious examples. It is not my view that current COVID restrictions are as bad as that or as ill-motivated as that. I think COVID is horrible and dangerous. It's not just a made-up problem. You know, 400,000 people have died. It's awful. But the fact that the crisis is real doesn't mean that we should just, that the courts should just engage in blanket deference any more than the fact that the war on terror is real should mean that there should have been blanket deference there, or that World War II was real meant that the courts were justified in deferring on things like the Japanese internment. So I think there's unquestionably a good deal of hypocrisy and a good deal of internally contradictory positions on all sides here. To my mind, I don't think that should relieve the court of its responsibility to engage in serious judicial review. I think this in particular is a relatively close case. Almost everybody else thinks it's very obviously right or very obviously wrong. I'm sort of weird and unusual in thinking that, you know, there's a relatively tough issue here, but I do differ with those who say, oh, it's a matter of public health, then we should just defer to what the government wants to do.
Dean Chemerinsky, any response to that?
Sure. I think I largely agree, though there's an underlying issue, and that's what's the appropriate degree of deference to the health judgments of the government. Ilya is absolutely right. There have been times where deference to what was claimed to be public health led to horrible results. Buck versus Bell, where the Supreme Court upheld the eugenics law in involuntary sterilization. But he also points out that at this point, I think it's over 420,000 people have died. It's a deadly communicable disease. There are many instances that we know of where the spread of disease has been tied to religious worship services. So I think what Justice Kagan is saying in her dissent is better to defer to the government in restricting religious worship services. And I think that what Justices Gorsuch and Thomas are saying at the other end is, no, we should be protecting religious worship and not deferring to the government. And I think the other justices were trying to strike something more of a middle position. I don't share Ilya's sense that there's a lot of hypocrisy going on here. I think there's real disagreement about the degree of deference that's appropriate to government officials. I think there's real disagreement about how important it is to protect free exercise of religion in this context.
Do you have any hope that Amy Coney Barrett won't be as conservative as some think she was going to be?
Everything that we know about Amy Coney Barrett, from the articles she wrote as a law professor, from the opinions she wrote in her couple years on the Seventh Circuit, suggests she's going to be a very conservative Supreme Court justice. Nothing to this point, but she's only been on the court since October 26th, suggests otherwise. Not many people have major changes in ideology when they go onto the Supreme Court. I'd love to be proven wrong. I'd be thrilled if she turns out to be as conservative as I think she's going to be, but I don't have a lot of hope.
All right. There's the optimism for today. We're going to talk about California versus Texas after the break. As usual, we don't have as much time as we'd like, so we're going to go through the rapid round when we come back. First is California versus Texas. You don't want to miss that. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Need some legal, moral, or just common sense advice from a friend? Call Alan Gervie at 800-222-KABC. That's 800-222-5222. Welcome back to Gervie's Law, turning Murphy's Law upside down on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
All right, we're back. I'm Alan Gervie. I'm talking to Dean Erwin Chemerinsky from Berkeley Law and to Ilya Soman, law professor at George Mason University. We just don't have enough time, but I want to go through the rapid round, guys. So here we go. I'm going to name some cases. Tell me your perspective. We'll try and keep each case down to about 2 minutes if possible. Starting with California versus Texas, Professor Soman.
So for those who don't know, this is the case where there's a challenge to the Obamacare program, another one where a bunch of red states led by the state of Texas have been arguing that now that the individual health insurance mandate included in the program, now that the monetary penalty has been eliminated, it can't be considered a tax anymore in the way that it was upheld previously in NFIB versus Sebelius. More controversially and more importantly, they say not only that this particular mandate should be struck down now, but that the entire rest of Obamacare should be eliminated along with it, because they say the mandate or what's left of it cannot be severed from the rest. And it's so important to the rest that it doesn't make sense to allow the rest to continue to exist without it. And my perspective on this case can be boiled down just to the idea that I think Texas is right about the unconstitutionality of what's left of the individual mandate, that even if you believe, which I do not believe, but even if you believe that the Supreme Court originally was right to uphold it as a tax, there can be no tax when the provision of law, even in principle, can't raise any money anymore. And therefore, they're right about that, but I think they're badly wrong about the issue of severability. I joined an amicus brief on that point with a number of other legal scholars in different sides of the political spectrum. It seems to me very obvious that on any theory of severability that is at all plausible, a mandate which has virtually no teeth can't possibly be considered so essential to the rest of the law that you can't believe that the rest of the law can be maintained without it. And when you listen to what happened in the oral argument on this case in November, I think it's pretty obvious that there is not anywhere near a majority of Supreme Court justices who will agree with Texas on the severability issue. I think there's at least six justices and possibly more who differ with them on that. So the only issue that I think really still remain to be seen what happens is what the court thinks about the constitutionality of what's left with the mandate. It's also possible that they will simply throw out the case based on the idea that Texas and the other states that are suing did not have standing. I disagree with that notion, but I do think it's a plausible argument under current Supreme Court standing doctrine.
Will Congress, do you believe Congress will take any action that will render the case moot?
I don't know. It's a good question. Some have proposed that the Democrats who now control both houses of Congress could fix this simply by saying, you know, there's a 1 cent penalty if you're not covered with insurance of the kind that Obamacare mandates. Alternatively, they could even more easily fix it simply by repealing what's left of the individual mandate. It's possible that either or both actions might be subject to filibuster rules. And if that's the case, then Senate Republicans may or may not want to filibuster, though it would be awkward for them to filibuster against repeal of what's left of the individual mandate, which they've always said they're against. But at this point, I'm not sure Congress will do anything on this because they have other priorities, and also because I think the Biden administration probably is confident that they're going to win the case, or rather that the case will come out the way they like, at least on the issue of severability, perhaps not on the mandate issue.
Dean Chemerinsky.
So far, I haven't heard any recent noise about Congress doing something, but
okay.
I admit it's possible I've missed something, that they do have a plan to do it, and I'm just not aware of it.
I feel like Chris Wallace. I need to cut you off. Dean Chemerinsky, 1 minute.
I agree with Ilya's analysis with regard to severability. Severability is the question of, even if one provision is declared unconstitutional, should the court strike down the whole law? And that's always a question of, would Congress have adopted the rest of the law without this provision? The answer here is clear. In December 2017, Congress had a bill to repeal the Affordable Care Act. It failed. Clear indication of congressional intent. The only thing I'd add is I think there's a chance that some of the justices, maybe even a majority, will say that Texas lacks standing here. Justice Thomas at the oral argument was really focusing on what's the injury? If there's no penalty, who's hurt by it? But bottom line is that I think he and I both agree that the Supreme Court's not going to declare unconstitutional the entire Affordable Care Act.
Dean Chemerinsky, Fulton v. City of Philadelphia in 2 minutes.
Philadelphia contracts with private social service agencies
to inspect and ultimately place children in foster homes. In order for a private contractor to do this for Philadelphia, it has to agree that it's not going to discriminate on the basis of race, sex, religion, or sexual orientation. Catholic Social Services refused to do that, saying that for religious reasons, it refused to place children with same-sex couples. It brought a challenge to this, saying it violated its free exercise of religion and it violated its free speech to impose this requirement. The federal district court ruled against Catholic Social Services in favor of the city of Philadelphia. The United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit agreed, and the Supreme Court heard oral argument on Wednesday, November 4th.
And the result will be?
Based on the ideology of the justices, I think that Catholic Social Services is going to win. I'm not sure how narrowly or how broadly the Supreme Court is going to rule. Some of those before the court suggested it could be a narrow ruling for Catholic Social Services. On the other hand, I think some of the justices would like a very broad ruling. I actually thought one of the most important questions at oral argument came from Justice Amy Coney Barrett, where she said, "We all agree that somebody on account of religious beliefs can't discriminate on the basis of race. Why should we allow someone on account of religious beliefs to discriminate based on sexual orientation?" And I agree. I think Philadelphia should win, but I don't think they're going to.
All right. We only have a minute. Real quick, NCAA versus Sean Alston. I'm going to ask both of you, will the results of this case blur the lines of pro athletes and college athletes? Professor Somin, you want to start?
I don't know how it's going to turn out, but certainly if the athletes prevail, then it will blur the line somewhat. But to be honest, that line is already blurred in the real world, because the way the NCAA functions, at least when you talk about Division I football and basketball, which is what this is mostly about, it's already in many ways a for-profit industry in everything but name. And so that the notion that these people are just amateur student athletes, frankly, in many ways, this notion only exists to perpetuate the NCAA's cartel, which makes it harder to pay these people salaries that they would otherwise command.
Dean Chemerinsky, should that be the case?
I totally and completely agree.
And
should that be the case?
Yes.
I think that
you see, you have to listen to the question. I changed it up a little bit for you.
Oh, okay.
I'm kidding. Yeah, do you believe it should be the case?
I do think that college athletes should be able to benefit from selling their name and likeness. I think that college athletes should be able to unionize. I think college athletes should get paid. Colleges make an enormous amount of money off of the athletes, and the athletes should be able to share in those profits. I think the distinction between pro and amateur in the context of major college sports is, as Ilya said, a farce.
Wow. You guys are agreeing much too much today, but I appreciate it because I think it really provides everyone, all the listeners, with some real substance of these cases. Erwin Chemerinsky, thank you so much for being with us. Ilya Somin, thanks for being with us. Really appreciate it.
Such a pleasure. Thank you both.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Be well, both of you. And thanks for listening to Gervie's Law. We'll see you next week.
The glass is always half full when you're listening to Gervie's Law on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
This show is pre-recorded and furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.